Monday afternoon, 30th August, 1982. Venerable sirs and venerable lady, I'm sorry, yesterday I did not complete my talk properly. Certain unexpected, sudden physical circumstances prevented me from doing it. So I think I'll just touch upon the point where we left off and then go on to the end of the talk, because that last page is somewhat important. We were considering our ordinary mode of consciousness, the manner in which we are aware of existence, and we saw that as we are here and now, we are aware of existence in terms of finitude, temporality, and mortality all along the line. Our consciousness is self-oriented, self-concerned. But there are occasions when we experience an extension of our ordinary consciousness, and the otherness of things and persons disappears, and all persons and things seem to become one with us. We feel completely in harmony with it all. We are conscious in terms of a totality, and so individuality, which is confined to ourself, loses its ordinary separative and isolated self-consciousness. And when this inclusive consciousness reaches full fruition, the limited context of the finite, temporal, and mortal is transformed into the unlimited context of the infinite, eternal, and immortal. And on the way towards that culmination, we go through the stage where we realize silence in all its different grades. The first silence comes with the second jhana, and that becomes deeper and deeper until there is the complete silence of all that pertains to the perishable context of mortality, the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. I use these three words for this unlimited context of the infinite, eternal, and immortal. Now note the nature of these words. They negate the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. But they negate that context without destroying the reality of the finite, etc. Not only with respect to your mind and consciousness, but also with respect to the actuality of all existing things and creatures, the so-called inanimate and animate, contained in your whole environment. This is the extraordinary thing that happens. You may remember the Buddha says he knew with his mind the mind of the other, and so forth. This is because of that extension of consciousness, and although he himself affirms that he lives permanently, abides permanently in that shunyata phala samadhi, which is all inclusive, nevertheless, he is also aware in terms of the finite and the particular at the same time. This is the great mystery of the total reality. You see what has happened. The false separation between the self and the not-self disappears, and with it so much conflict, anxiety, pain, and grief. In short, the whole of dukkha. Your mode of awareness of existence has transcended all finitude. The Buddha said to the Brahman, Pingala Kocha, comes in the first volume of the Majjhima, this brahmacharya, this living of the holy life, is not for advantage in gains, honors, fame, morality, samadhi, knowledge, and vision. That which is unshakable freedom of mind, that is the goal of the Brahma faring. That is the pith. That is the culmination. The infinite, eternal, and immortal is the context of the wholly religious mind, the wholly religious mind of the perfectly matured consciousness. It is the unborn, unaging, undying, unsorrowing, unstained. It is, in short, transcendence. But transcendence subsumes the entire realm of dukkha. And this is something which is not easy to feel or see. That which is the perishable is entirely subsumed by the imperishable. The perishable cannot subsume the imperishable. Think, if you want to measure the Atlantic, you can't use your teacup and measure the Atlantic. The Atlantic will measure all teacups and subsume them. I mean subsume in that sense. And it could also mean that the transcendent completely interpenetrates that which is the perishable and the mortal. Completely interpenetrates. In a sense similar to the interpenetration by space of everything that exists in the cosmos. Every material thing that exists in the cosmos. So, by subsuming the entire realm of dukkha, by transcendence subsumes the entire realm of dukkha, for unless there is a relationship by virtue of this subsumption, a conduit, that is, a path, cannot be made leading us out of the mortal into the deathless. And there is no release possible then. On each person's shoulders rests the responsibility for building that conduit. Sila, Samadhi, Panya is the name of that conduit. Now, Buddhism is one of the main world religions. The word religion means that which restores man to his source. Cicero used the word re legere in this context, which means to gather together. And it seems to me that perhaps he may have felt towards religion in the sense of which is embodied in the Sangha, a gathering together. You remember how Jesus said that he came to redeem the lost sheep of Israel. Jesus put it in a somewhat limited form, didn't he? Only the lost sheep of Israel. What about all the others? They could go astray if they wished, perhaps. And now, Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine used the term re ligare as the source of the word religio, religion. And that means to bind back, which in a way is somewhat similar to the definition of yoga. Yoga is from the root yuj, means to bind back, to yoke, to bind back to transcendence itself. Now this binding back means a reintegration of the person into the total reality, the one total reality. The reintegration of the person means that the totality now takes the person completely into itself. And those which were all the perishable elements from rupa to vijnana constituting the existential being are now in the transcendent state, which is infinite, eternal, immortal, therefore immeasurable, incomparable, all criteria and so forth which we have disappear altogether where that is concerned. Now, these are very difficult things. Theistic theologians object very strongly to Hindu-Buddhist ideas along these lines. The root of Buddhism is the body of teaching regarding the living of the holy life given by Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. The title Buddha means the wake, the awakened one. There are epithets connecting him with the sun or fire. For example, the eye in the world, the eye which sees the whole world. He is called Satchanama. His name is Truth. He is called the conqueror of death, teacher of gods and men. The most characteristic synonyms are Brahma Bhuta and Dhamma Bhuta. Dhamma become, he's become the doctrine. He's the embodiment of the doctrine. And he is Brahma Bhuta. And this must be remembered very carefully, especially considering how he himself declares to his bhikkhus, "Bhikkhus, I am a Brahman." And when he said Brahma Bhuta, and this comes in his words to Vasettha in the Digha Nikaya, the third volume of the Digha Nikaya, when he said that, he definitely meant exactly what the Upanishadic teachers meant when they said, at least I think so, when they said, "Aham Brahmasmi," I am Brahman. I would have preferred them to have said, "Brahman is me." To say "I am Brahman" sounds as a peculiar, the word "I" has a peculiar egoistic flavor to it. But these are the most characteristic synonyms for the Buddha. After the supreme enlightenment, the Sammāsambodhi, he is no longer in a category, no longer this man so-and-so. Siddhartha Gautama addressed the royal palace Kapilavattu, Jambudvipa. He is no longer that. The proper epithets, some of which he himself uses, and he uses constantly this epithet, Arahant. He just calls himself Arahant, meaning the worthy one. He is called Bhagava, dispenser, the bountiful one. That's a wonderful way of putting it, the bountiful one. In the Rig Veda, Bhaga is the god who is the giver of good things, the giver of good fortune. Good fortune in the spiritual sense, nothing to do with stock exchange gains and all that sort of stuff. Tathagata, thus gone, or perhaps we may say thus arrived. He is called Mahapurisa, the great man. Uttarapurisa, he who has gone beyond, the further man, if you like. This reminds me of Sri Krishna in the Gita calling himself, he is the Purushottama, the supreme ultimate man. And in this sense of Uttarapurisa or Purushottama, the identification is with man, capital M, capital A, capital N, as primordially conceived in by transcendence itself. If you study the Hermetic writings, Hermes Trismegistus gives the teaching that the mind in the thought, that the thought in the mind of God created man co-equal to himself. Now that man obviously had no flesh and bones, or was not a creature as we know man, evolved from a primate. So in that sense, man is the word man really represents a divine conception, something quite over quite beyond our capacity to imagine. He is also called anoma, unfathomable. Time and again, the Buddha says, the Tathagata is trackless. You can't trace the Tathagata. Liberty, vimutti, is his. Nibbana, the complete extinction of the fires of lust, hate, and delusion, is his. And the full and perfect understanding of the meaning of the deathless, amatam, is his. We think in terms of mortality and an opposite which we call immortality. This is a mistaken way of thinking. The transcendent completely subsumes what we may call the non-transcendent. Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. Those are the very first words opening his wonderful ministry for 45 years. Note carefully that hearken because the deathless has been found. He doesn't say, I have gained the deathless. I and gain, those two are out. The deathless has been found, which seems to me to have the implication that that finding is not by the individual pursuing his desire to find something or other, but by the removal of all that obstructs, and all that obstructs is the perishable and mortal. By the removal of all that, the actuality, the supreme actuality, is present. That is why I always say, you never enter Nirvana or the kingdom of heaven. You, used in the sense of you the existential being, or I the existential being. But if all the obstructions are removed, then transcendence manifests itself through its temporary clothing. The supreme beatitude of Nibbana, which always emerges as and when there is the complete extinction of the fires of lust, hate, and delusion, that supreme beatitude of Nibbana is not sensational. It is not a feeling. It is not a thought. It is not pleasure, happiness, joy. Perhaps we may say it is a blissful calm, an ineffable peace, which is not dependent upon any cause whatsoever or any condition. It is unconditioned, imperishable, immutable. Of the essence of transcendence, beyond all description, unimaginable, inconceivable. It is there, but it is realizable. It comes into being through you insofar as Buddhahood has flowered out in you. The Buddha, who ever constantly abides in this beatitude, in the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, taught the Buddha Dhamma, outstandingly characterized by its ethical idealism and the well-being and happiness of devas. The Buddha's basic concerns were for pure religion and the well-being and happiness of devas and all men. Shortly before his death, and also when he sent out the first 60 arahats to spread the Dhamma, very soon after he began his ministry, he addresses the bhikkhus assembled in the Kutagara hall in the Mahavana near Vesali as follows. Therefore, because ye who have been taught by me the Dhamma, which I have fully understood, having thoroughly made yourselves masters of them, practice them, meditate upon them, and spread them abroad in order that Brahma-faring, the holy life, may last long and be perpetuated, in order that it may continue to be for the good and happiness of the great multitudes, out of compassion for the world, and for the good and benefit and happiness of devas and men. Sila, Samadhi and Panya, the three main themes which we have mentioned, serve this end. The silas are the means of purification, and the purity of daily life is the indispensable foundation of religious living. The Buddha dismisses rituals and ceremonies as ineffective means for purification. In the Majjhima, you will find a discourse in which the Brahman Sundarika Bharadvaja, after hearing a discourse by the Buddha, asks him, "Does the revered Gotama go down to wash in the river Bahuka, considered by the populace as a means of purification by washing away the evil deeds that have been done?" The Buddha, in addition to the Bahuka, mentions the names of six other rivers and says, "A fool, though entering constantly, does not cleanse his dark deed. Rivers do not cleanse the hostile, guilty man intent on evil deeds." And he adds immediately, "For the pure, every day is auspicious, every day is holy. For the pure of bright deeds, there is ever the practice of good deeds. Bathe in this only. Make all creatures secure. If you do not speak a lie, if you harm no living thing, if you take nothing ungiven, if you are not stingy, and if you have faith, what can you do by going to rivers or wells?" In the Digha Nikaya, we have a very interesting discourse, a very long one too. The Brahman, Kutadanta, the name means pointed tooth. Kutadanta enjoyed the royal domain of Hanumata, presented to him by King Seniya Bimbisara of Magadha. The Buddha, touring through Magadha, was lodging nearby in the Ambalattika Plaisance, together with many bhikkhus. Kutadanta, desiring as comfortable a place in the next world after his death as in this, decides to celebrate a sacrifice involving the slaughter of hundreds of animals in honor of a god. Having heard that a Samana Gotama was in the vicinity, he goes to him for advice on all the details concerning the sacrifice. A long conversation, as detailed in the Digha, it occupies about 30 pages of print, ensues, in which Gotama expounds practically his entire teaching of the silas, mindfulness, contentment, solitude, Samadhi, Panya, and the destruction of the asavas, and ends by saying, "And there is no sacrifice man can celebrate, O Brahman, higher and sweeter than this." Kutadanta then offers his praise to Gotama in the usual way and invites him and the bhikkhus to a meal the next day, and adds this: "And I myself, O Gotama, will have the 700 bulls, 700 steers, 700 heifers, 700 goats, 700 rams set free. To them I grant their life. Let them eat green grass and drink fresh water, and may cool breezes waft around them." There's something very touching and lovely, something which I like to call so sweet about the whole situation, isn't it? Here is the enlightened one, the embodiment of transcendent truth, speaking to this professional Brahman, a professional priest, who is about to perform a bloodthirsty, bloody sacrifice. And just the words of the teacher so alter his whole outlook, not only his whole outlook, but his inner consciousness. This is the important point. When one's inner consciousness is transformed, then one is on the right path. And this is what happens. With respect to basic human morality, the Buddha confirms the precepts which prevailed over all India in those days. Refraining from killing, hurting, or harming any creatures. Refraining from any form of theft. Refraining from all sensuous indulgence. Indulgence, not full and right use of the senses. It's very important to note this. All the teachers have spoken of the right and proper use of the senses. And if that is there, then the senses must not be indulged. That means tainted by the desire to have more and more of this sense impression come to you. To refrain from lying, harsh, rough, frivolous speech. This is particularly important in our day and age, and in all societies. Listen to conversation anywhere and everywhere. Continuous, non-stop chatter. Things which are not worth talking about. It's extraordinary how we are the most awful cacophony makers intruding upon the peace of the world. Refraining from all intoxicants. Now, whilst the populace tends to confine these to physical actions, all the great teachers emphasized the necessity of observing all the virtues in thought and feeling and speech and act. If you look at the Shandilya Upanishad, which is called one of the minor Upanishads, it really is a major one, the teacher says outright that all the virtues must be practiced in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. If they are firmly established in our thought and feeling, then they will naturally follow in speech and action, which are the external expressions of the internal grace. Thus only can the entire psychophysical organism be purified, made whole, holy. Only with moral saintship as the foundation can the religious life in its profound aspects begin to blossom. That is, begin to be a transforming and healing power for oneself and for the environment. Understanding the importance of purification, we see that whatsoever purifies and perfects a man, relates him fully to life and allows the realization of transcendence is religion. Anything which does that we may call religion. The most powerful stumbling block we encounter is sense pleasures. The Buddha says, sense pleasures are likened by me to a skeleton, a lump of meat, a torch of dry grass, a pit of glowing embers, a bad dream. The translation actually has the word dream. I'm adding the word bad. There are some dreams which are perhaps not to be despised. Something borrowed, a slaughterhouse, an impaling stake, a snake's head. This comes in the Alugadupama Sutta, in the first volume of the Majjhima. Sense pleasures are said by me to be of little satisfaction, of much pain, much tribulation, wherein is more peril. It's extraordinary. This teaching has come through millennia, and yet the whole world is the slave of sense pleasure and the search for sense pleasure. The Buddha's strictures and warnings must be clearly understood and guide our conduct. Especially today, more than ever, the world is hell-bent on sense pleasures. It is not happiness which the Buddha decries, but the slavery to pleasure lust and the senseless pursuit thereof, which is the destructive factor. We know today that there are pleasure areas in the brain. If you read Dr. J.H. Campbell's book on this subject, you will find some very interesting material. The body needs pleasure in order to be healthy, but it must be the right sort of pleasure. In the pure-minded man, his psyche free of ambivalence and conflict, his body clean living, all his senses function at their highest intensity and refinement. Sensitized to this degree, remaining poised and observing intently, all that comes to you through the senses gives you happiness quite beyond that which mortals ordinarily experience. We all experience the pleasure here, the right sort of happiness. Look at the beauty of the trees which surround us here. They are wonderful poise, the rhythm of their lives, their sort of coordination, the way they seem to be in meditation, in prayer, if you like, in contemplation. Think of all that is done in the way of these beautiful flower arrangements which we owe to Stella and her assistance. Now this sort of happiness comes, just comes. We don't crave for it. We haven't a lust for it. We enjoy it as it comes, and we don't grasp it. And that is the finest aspect of pure enjoyment, not to grasp it. Enjoy it, experience it, and pass on. It's like the perfume of a flower. You can't catch hold of that perfume and keep it for yourself like that. This happiness uplifts the heart, ennobles the mind, elicits a deeper realization of what it means to be human, and releases one into a closer unity with all the world. I often am awake at about 3:30 in the morning. And just this month, looking out of the window, and when the skies have been clear, the magnificent splendor of Orion and all the constellations around Orion just fill me with an extraordinary quiet happiness, a real pleasure in the supreme sense of the word. And it's the same when I listen to music like the last quartets of Beethoven or the Missa Solemnis, particularly the Benedictus. That's just sheer magic. Now you can't grasp that. The music sounds and it is gone, finished. You can't grasp that. But it can have a permanent effect in transforming your awareness of the world in such a manner that you are living the holy life in the real sense. In the Bahuvedaniya Sutta, the Buddha speaks on happiness to Ananda. Now this is rather interesting. Having said all these things against sense pleasures, listen to what he says here. He begins with pleasure through the senses and says, whatever happiness, joy, arises in consequence of the five strands of sense pleasures, it is called happiness in sense pleasures. He just states the fact. It is happiness in sense pleasures. Then he disallows any affirmation that is the highest joy and happiness that creatures can experience, and proceeds to a more excellent happiness when, aloof from sense pleasures, from unskilled states of mind, the nivaranas, the five hindrances particularly, one enters and abides in the first jhana. Now you know, he experienced something like this when he was very young. On the occasion when the state ploughing took place, the Sakyan community would go out and carry out this state ploughing. The ruler himself, his father himself, he had a golden plough, and there were, I think, about 300 or so silver ploughs which the big shots of the community used, and the ordinary folk used the ordinary ploughs, and they had this ceremony. And whilst this ceremony was taking place, the Buddha went and sat under a rose apple tree, Caryophyllus jambus, you see, and there he entered into the state of the first jhana, in that contemplative mood. And what he noticed, that the happiness, the calm happiness which he experienced, did not impinge upon his mind. In the translation, the word impinge is used. I imagine that it meant it did not disturb his mind or upset the poise of his mind. Now that was his first experience, and this comes in the first jhana. Disallowing that as the highest, he proceeds step by step through all the jhanas and samapattis to the ninth state of entering upon and abiding in the stopping of all perception and feeling. Then the Buddha proceeds to say something of the utmost significance and importance. He tells Ananda, members of other sects may say, the recluse Gotama speaks of the stopping of perception and feeling, and lays down that this belongs to happiness. Now, what is this? How can this be? The ordinary man could not possibly understand how happiness could be divorced from sense excitement, sensational delight. Couldn't understand it. And the Buddha goes on, Ananda, those belonging to other sects should be answered thus. Your reverences, the Lord does not lay down that it is only pleasant feeling that belongs to happiness. For, your reverences, the Tathagata lays down that whenever, wherever, whatever happiness is found, it belongs to the sphere of happiness. The name of his cousin, Ananda, this is the blissful calm, the beatitude which accompanies Nibbana. Ananda. Pronounce the word in the right way and you'll get the feel of it. Ananda. Throughout his ministry, the Buddha constantly exhorted his bhikkhus to refrain from immorality in deeds of body, of speech, and of thought. On one occasion at the Jeta Grove near Savatthi in Anathapindika's park, he tells the bhikkhus, there are two kinds of wrongdoing. One, that which has its result in this very life, and two, that which has its result in a future life. In connection with the first type, he cites what happens to a robber when he is caught. He mentions in detail the punishments inflicted. They are absolutely blood-curdling. I've got the first volume of the Anguttara Nikaya upstairs, pages 42 and 43. You read them if you've got a very strong heart. An observer of such punishments would feel, the Buddha says, if I were to do deeds for which rulers treat a robber thus, they would surely treat me in like manner. And then the Buddha says something, and I pick a bone with the Buddha here. Thoroughly scared, he refrains from robbing. These are his actual words. Thoroughly scared. In connection with the second type, the onlooker thinks, evil in the future life is the fruit of bodily offense and also of offense by speech and by thought. After death, would not I be reborn in the waste, the way of woe, the downfall in purgatory? The Buddha says then, thus scared at the thought of wrongdoing to be atoned for in a future life, he abandons immorality in act, speech, and thought. Instead, he cultivates morality therein and conducts himself with utter purity. And the Buddha goes on to say, wherefore, bhikkhus, train yourselves thus. We will fear wrongdoing with immediate or future retribution and shun wrongdoing. Of one who does so, it may be expected that he will be released from all wrongdoing. In that day and age, the Buddha also, like his Brahmanical predecessors and contemporaries, subscribed to the idea of fear of painful punishment as a deterrent from immorality. But how effective has fear as a deterrent been since man stepped onto the world stage? Precious little. The Buddha does time and again introduce fear as a power to prevent and save us from evil. And indeed, time and again, it has prevented a man from committing a crime. But fear never heals. One may be deterred, but you are not healed thereby. Anything which forcibly prevents never heals the sick psyche. In our 20th century, people are increasingly waking up to the fact that deep insight, which makes us clearly see the truth, is the real healing power. And wheresoever and whensoever the liberating truth operates, there also compassion, wisdom, and grace function. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it is related that the Buddha, while at the shrine of Chapala, deliberately and consciously rejected the rest of his natural term of life. Thereupon there arose a mighty earthquake, awful and terrible, and the thunders of heaven burst forth. It's rather interesting, Jesus on the cross, after he said the second time, after he cried again, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and yielded up his spirit, the veil of the temple was rent from top to bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks were rent. And another earthquake took place when the two Marys came along on the Sunday morning to see the tomb. That's just by the way. Ananda, who was sitting at the foot of a tree not far from the Buddha when this earthquake took place, wondering what might be the proximate and the remote causes of this earthquake, went up to the Blessed One and put his question to him. The Buddha answered that there were 8 proximate and 8 remote causes. In brief, the first was as follows. This earth is established on water, water on wind, wind rests upon space. When mighty winds blow, waters are shaken, and this shakes the earth. The German scholar Windisch of the last century, I think, in his book Mara and Buddha, on page 61, adduces a number of European parallels to this sort of explanation. The second explanation the Buddha gives is this. When a recluse or deva or fairy of mighty mental power meditates intensely on the idea of the minutest portion of earth in relation to the widest expanse of water, he can make the earth shake. In view of our modern scientific knowledge about earthquakes, I personally do not understand these explanations, nor can I accept them as they stand. Nor the next 6, which say that earthquakes, awful and terrible, take place when the Bodhisattva descends from the Tushita heaven into Queen Mahamaya's womb, when he quits his mother's womb, attains the supreme enlightenment, the Sammāsambuddhi, when he founds the kingdom of righteousness, turns the wheel of the law, when he rejects the remainder of his lifespan, and when he enters the final parinibbana, the utter passing away without remainder. If these 6 were to be taken literally, how can we reconcile them with compassion? Earthquakes have cruel and destructive effects on all that lives. There may be one way at least to understand them, these explanations. But I'll come to that in a moment. How can we associate the sort of great features in the life of the Bodhisattva and the Buddha with something which causes such distress to mankind? I can't do that at all. That is why I completely discard this sort of explanation. But there may be one way at least to understand them. Consider the meaning of the names. Mahamaya, his mother, the great illusion. He descends, it is said, from the Tushita heaven. I'm not regarding this Tushita heaven as an otherworldly state. But you know how Suddhodana, his father, surrounded him with sense pleasures, with all the sense pleasures available in this world. That was his Tushita heaven. Here and now, whilst alive. That was his Tushita heaven. He descends into the womb of the great illusion. When he goes out, goes forth from home to homelessness. And there he realizes, as he meditates upon everything that has happened to him and so forth, that all this Tushita heaven was a mighty illusion. And now, in his deep meditation, he's right in this illusion. He's grappling with his illusion. Then when he quits the womb, his mother's womb, this womb which is the great illusion, and receives enlightenment, then that's the next stage. And then all the other stages which are mentioned, the turning of the wheel of the law and all the rest of it, we may think of these things as earth-shaking events. Like when a Newton or an Einstein or whoever it is, some great philosopher or scientist makes a discovery or brings forth an idea which is really a world-shaking idea. All right? I'm afraid I'm materialistic enough to want to make sense of all religious of all scriptural statements. If they don't make sense in some real way, I don't say that this is false, I leave it alone. It was mentioned earlier that shortly before his death, the Buddha gave his bhikkhus the mandate to teach the Dhamma they had mastered to all people in order to spread and perpetuate the true and pure religion and for the well-being, benefit and happiness of devas and men, out of compassion for the whole world. Now this is a wonderful thing, this mandate. And you know, you get the corresponding thing happening in the life of Jesus when he sends out his disciples. By the way, did Jesus send them out singly or in pairs? The Buddha sends them out in pairs. Anyone know? Jesus sent them out in pairs. Yes, it's a curious. There is so much correspondence between the life of Jesus and the life of the Buddha, and I dare say it is the same with all the other great teachers too. In the Pasadika Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, there is a succinct summary of these Dhamma, as also in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. They are 1. The four earnest meditations. 2. The fourfold great struggle against evil. 3. The four roads to saintship. 4. The five moral powers. And these are the same as number 5, the five organs of spiritual sense. 6. The seven kinds of wisdom. And 7, the Aryan Eightfold Path. Now, 4 and 5, the roads, five moral powers and the five organs of spiritual sense consist of faith, energy, thought, contemplation, wisdom. The seven kinds of wisdom consist of energy, thought, contemplation. Note that those three occur in all three categories. Investigation of scripture, joy, repose, serenity. It's very interesting. He mentions joy. And of course, serenity, the ananda, which comes with supreme enlightenment. 7, the Aryan Eightfold Path. Well, you all know that. I'll just repeat it. Perfect understanding, perfect aspiration, perfect speech, perfect conduct. And as regards the Samma Ajiviko, it's translated as perfect livelihood. Well, for the bhikkhus, that was perhaps the main element. But for us ordinary mortals, we must extend it, I think. I like to translate it as perfect mode of living, which includes how we obtain our livelihood. Perfect endeavor, perfect mindfulness, perfect samadhi, communion, I like to translate it as. Samadhi is that which culminates in the supreme togetherness. In the state of samadhi, the existential being which is there in samadhi is no longer separate in any sense, either in consciousness or in feeling or in action, from the totality. And that is the ultimate meditative state. This is the question. It is said that the only way to make the world a better place is to stop competition in all its aspects, to stop comparison, measurement, aggressiveness, etc. But this process is not instantaneous, so those who start it will not have a chance of survival, or will they? Well, I think the question, we might make an alteration or two in the wording of the question. It is said that the only way to make the world a better place is to stop competition, comparison, etc. How are you going to stop it? If there are people who want to compete, what can you do? Are you going to stop them forcibly? You can't do it. They will compete. People, again, constantly make comparisons. And making comparisons is a way of inducing and perpetuating separation, divisiveness. This is better than that. I like Rita better than Anita. Why have I insulted Anita in comparing her with Rita? You see? But can I be stopped from that by force? That is the point. And then the question goes on, but this process is not instantaneous. Of course it isn't instantaneous. So those who start it will not have a chance of survival. Don't quite understand. Who will not have a chance of survival? Those who start it? Start the stopping the others? Or will they? The question is really a very good question, because this sort of thing is a very powerful divisive factor in the life of the world. How are we going to help in releasing mankind from all ill states? No one can be legislated into goodness. No one can be compelled to be good. One can't compel oneself even to be good. So many people do, and they say self-control, and they exercise their will and bend all their efforts to stop themselves from evil thinking, feeling, doing, and so forth. But this simply exacerbates the conflict in the psyche. No sort of predetermined concept applied forcibly to alter the psyche and to purify it will purify it. It won't purify that way. How does a doctor work? He examines the ill patient, the patient, and discovers the illness. Often the patient himself knows, I've got flu or whatever it is. You see? He discovers the thing. He diagnoses the disease. He understands, therefore, what is the condition of that ill body. And understanding that, and having mastered the technical skill in connection with his art as a doctor, he prescribes the medicine. And if the patient is patient enough and sensible enough to follow his advice, he may get well again. All right. But what are the important factors? The understanding of the situation, the truth of the matter with the sick body. Now we, in the same way, have to examine, investigate, as the Buddha used to say, our sick psyche, our own sick psyche, because it is our sick psyche which brings about comparison, measurement, aggressiveness, and all the rest of it. You see? Now, if we understand it, if we really understand it as such, and are free of making excuses for ourselves and so forth, we will free ourselves from all these ills. And if we free ourselves from all these ills, then we naturally radiate a psychical energy which is a healing energy upon the on the environment, acting on the environment. You know, very few people ever understand this kind of thing or realize that here is the real way. They think of healing, ordinarily they think of healing as counteracting or using some sort of dope. Counteraction and dope will never truly heal. It will temporarily alleviate the symptoms. But the actual healing is through complete understanding. And then there is the release of a totally different state of consciousness within oneself. That is the healing agent. Now one may say, but good gracious, all right, you and I can live the holy life in the right way, practice samadhi and all the rest of it, and discover and find out and heal ourselves. But how is that going to solve the immediate problems of the world? You won't solve the immediate problems of the world, because they are too vast, they are too big. There are 4 or 5 of us. There are 4,000 millions in the world who are opposed to us. What can you do? If an atom bomb dropped upon the Buddha, that would be the end of him, absolutely. You see? And yet, perfection can affect can have an extraordinary effect. You know how the sun, for example, exercises a tremendous healing influence upon the earth and upon all that lives and breathes and moves on the earth. In the same way, he who has become a light unto himself, who has become holy, healed, whole, his presence has a healing influence upon the environment. In course of time, that will bring about its own inevitable results, its own inevitable consequences. Mankind progresses very slowly. Study the way man has evolved and the way he has gradually changed through millions of years. We know a little bit about it. We do know a little bit about it. If you study that very carefully, you will see that the way in which man progresses is the gradual way. It's not the sudden way, the instantaneous way. Krishnamurti always talks of now, instantly, the thing happens. But consider carefully. He himself went through all the stages, and when the climactic point was reached, suddenly it happened. If you take a solution of potassium iodide and say ferrous sulfate, you see, and they are clear solutions, mix the two together, and then you suddenly get a precipitate of ferrous iodide. You see, it's like that. This precipitation takes place suddenly, instantaneously, because all the preceding conditions are present. All right, they are there, and the thing happens then. Now, where the psyche is concerned, and where the life of the mind is concerned, things do happen very quickly where the mind is concerned. If there is the tendency, a natural gift, if you like, within oneself in a certain direction, as far as that direction is concerned, if the right stimulus comes in time and space, as and when it comes, then there'll be a sudden, oh yes, I see, I've got it. You see? And then it is instantaneous. And we are inclined to say, oh, it happens instantaneously. But everything doesn't happen instantaneously like that. In the manifested universe, which is the universe of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal, you see, things grew. Time and space came into being after the Big Bang. And from that time onwards, from that moment onwards, just 1 to the -43rd of a second after that, after the singularity, the Big Bang took place, 1 to the -43rd of a second, 1 divided by 1 with 43 noughts after it, of a second. Rather a short time, you know. And then time and space came out and imposed all its conditions and its laws upon the entire universal process, including ourselves. That must be borne in mind. If an animal could talk and think like us, up to a certain point, and you talk to him about instantaneity, he would say, what's the matter with this fellow? Ask the chimpanzee to talk with you and tell him about this instantaneous change. He says, no way. No go. Everything steadily, slowly, gradually. But the gradualness and the knowledge of the gradualness, whilst it operates most powerfully in the solid realm, can become a quicker process. And where the mind is concerned, where when I say mind in this case, I mean insight is concerned, insight can take place if the organism is fit for it at the time. But then again, there is the condition. If the organism is fit, it will happen. Otherwise, it won't. So, this is perhaps the reason why the great teachers, say like Sri Krishna, said, "Thy business is with the action only, not with the fruits of action. Don't bother about the fruits of action. See what is the right thing. And when you are certain, when you have tested out and found that this is the good thing, the right thing, then proceed. Proceed quietly, cautiously, because we have to consider other people too. Otherwise, you know, we'd be like some people in a queue who do that and push the others out. And that is not exactly living the holy life. Now, I'll go on. Also, if one shouldn't resist, then what becomes of personal freedom in its social context? Well, we certainly might lose our personal freedom or have it diminished. What is the answer to that? Not to struggle for regaining what we imagine is personal freedom. Accept the situation. Understand it. It's the quiet fellow, the calm fellow, who wins out. I remember very well what C.B. Fry, the famous cricketer, used to tell me. In the years 1936 and 1937, he used to come to my house in London almost twice a week. He was very interested in certain things I was doing and so forth. And of course he would start talking about cricket. And if he said this once, he said it 100 times. When you're batting, as you see the bowler come running, lift the bat, keep your eye on the ball, don't think of the bowler, and keep your eye on the ball all the time and see how the ball is moving and knock it for six. he had remarkable records, captain of England, captain of cricket, captain of football. He had the 100 yards championship sprint period and all that sort of thing. He was an extraordinary man, very vain and egotistical, but some extraordinary things about him. I came to know him extremely well because he came so often to the house. So now, if we lose our personal freedom, all right, accept it quietly. And if one can accept it quietly, it will in all likelihood either be given back by whatever force or power or person has filched it from you, or it will just re-establish itself. You know, they say the way to deal with a lion, if you meet him in the forest, to just look at the gentleman. Just look steadily at him. He won't hurt you. He'll walk away. Don't try it with a tiger. The tiger is a very different kettle of fish. Yes. All right. Then it goes on. the more one gives, the more one gives in and gives up, the more inner freedom one has. But if one has to see for oneself and rebel and resist against following blindly other people's opinions and manipulations, at first view it seems a catch-22 problem. I don't quite know what catch-22 is, but I can sort of have a vague guess at what it might mean. Yes, of course. See, we have to have infinite patience. We have to be very patient with the devil, first within oneself. I am the devil, I am God also. And you know, it's one of the extraordinary things that in the scriptures of the world, the devil has play for a period, and then he goes to hell where he belongs. And there comes a time when the devil is released. You know, in Revelation, he is released after 1,000 years. But if he doesn't transform into God, he will be back in hell. It's a very interesting thing. The devil is never exterminated, never killed. Because all that you can do is to transform the devil. The devil represents energy acting harmfully. That's what the devil represents. But energy cannot be destroyed. It's indestructible. You can transform it. Make it serve good purposes. So that's, I think, as much as I can say about that question. Now the next one. Would you say that the purified psyche, which allows transcendence to shine through, is the same as the Buddha's teaching of anatta? The Buddha's teaching of anatta is, if I'm not mistaken, is concerned with the khandhas, the elements which compose the nama rupa, the existential being who is living here and now, who is born, who lives and dies. He declared that all the elements, we won't go through the whole list, we'll just use the word nama and rupa, psyche and body. It's always, of course, nama is translated by the Buddhist world as mind. But you know why I prefer to use the word mind in a special sense and use the word psyche instead. Nama is anatta. It has nothing in it which is a permanent, unchanging, identifiable entity. That's what he said. And the same with rupa, with the form. Nothing in it which is an unchanging, undying, permanent entity, identifiable entity. But you know, he also said, when he pointed these things out, in order from rupa to vinyana, etc., right up to from rupa through vedana, sanya, sankara up to vinyana, he also said, look at it with right wisdom and see, this is not the self of me. He said this is not mine. This am I not. Note the words very carefully. This am I not. implying that the I as a reality is something different. That's the implication. And then he ends up with na me so atta. Na me so atta. This is not the atta of me. And in that context, atta is decidedly the same as the Upanishadic Atma. And the Atma is the transcendent. It is not an entity. It is that which belongs to the context of the infinite, eternal and immortal. In the Chandogya Upanishad, Prajapati says to the Indra and Virochana, the two who came seeking knowledge, he said to them, the Atma is unborn, unaging, undying, birthless, sorrowless, hungerless, thirstless. It is that which must be sought. You see, what did the Buddha say of himself in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta? Seeking the unborn, the unaging, etc. He sought the Atma, and no other than the Atma of the Upanishads. The Pali word is Atta. There are so many contexts where this thing comes. When he says again, that will come in my talk either tomorrow or day after, I think, you see. When he says, self upbraids self. Attanam atta upavadati. Something like that. I've got the thing written up, so you'll get the proper thing, you see. So now, if he says self upbraids self, which self upbraids which self? He refused to talk about transcendence, things transcendent. He refused to talk about it, simply because in his day and age, there wasn't the intellectual tools available to put it in a form which was not too inadequate. See, what all that we can do as we progress through the centuries is to make less and less mistaken pronouncements. The absolute truth has no pronouncement at all. So all we can do is to make less and less inadequate pronouncements. Now, we have then to really to understand where to apply the word anatta, in which context we must use it. The word anatta is used only in the context of the existential being, the rupa to vijnana, the nama rupa, in fact. So, when the psyche is everything from vedana to vijnana, that's the psyche. When that is completely purified, it becomes completely empty of all vedana, sanya, sankhara, and its discriminative quality of consciousness, which is the analytical splitting up quality. You see? And then pure mind, the Buddha mind, has come to fruition, complete fruition, and that is what is meant when I say that transcendence shines through the completely purified psyche. So it is not the same as the Buddha's teaching of anatta. It is related to it, if you like, because anatta belongs to nama rupa. All right?
That practical way of putting the self with S capital and self with a small s.
Yes. You know, I dislike the use of the word self, because, you know, when we use a language, it is best to use that language in its own specific meanings. In the English language, self means this fellow.
This fellow, yes.
You see? And if you start capitalizing this, you'll get all the troubles and tragedies of a capitalist world order. No.
But there's always a problem. How do you pronounce the lesser, smaller case letter self as opposed to the larger case letter, the capital letter self? You can't really in speech.
You see, that self is the absolute.
Yeah.
Is Eckhart's Gottheit. Or if you like, you can even use the word God. If we can get sufficiently far as God, it is sufficient for us.
Yes.
You see, it's God and the person, the creator and the created. And where Roman Catholicism made its mistake was to say that the creator is wholly other than the created. That's where Roman Catholic theology founded, as also in the statement that God is a personal being. You can grant personality if you like in certain meanings, but to say he is an identifiable being, an identifiable entity, then you are really talking philosophical nonsense, because every entity comes into being, proceeds in space and time, and then, as we say, dies, or if you like, is completely transformed into something else. Shakespeare's wonderful words in The Tempest, "Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes, of him nothing doth remain, but is changed into something rich and strange." Shakespeare, in his inner consciousness, knew the contrast of transcendence with the perishable.